Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about the context switch. We started by mentioning, well, previously we had realized that, oh, the thing we're doing for exception handling, where we just like kind of like a function call, we want to like save the state of what was going on so we can restore it before we return back. Then an exception call, and that turns out to be how we deal with the user mode part of a context switch in XV6. That we, when we enter the kernel, we say what the user mode code was doing, and we restore it before we return, and we just reuse that code for a context switch, because what we have to do it anyways when there's no context switch. We had this extra kernel part of the context switch where we needed to save the stuff the kernel was working on so we could go back to it later. And the mechanism for that was basically we saved all the registers for what was currently running, restored all the things for the thing we were switching to. And the implementation that XV6 used for this had this trick, which is very common in operating systems, that, well, function calls do part of this work for us. They already do the work of saving some of the registers, because that's how function calls work, and they already do the work of saving where to go back to, because that's how return addresses work, and we kind of need to return from functions to different locations depending on where they're called. So we just reuse that effort in XV6's implementation of the switch function, which handles the kernel part of the context switch. So once we knew about sort of how we save and restore things, we mentioned, well, okay, so we have to track information about currently running threads, and we mentioned that we have a process which has threads and some other stuff. We have to track information about processes. And our generic name for a structure which tracks that information is a thread control block for information about a thread, and a process control block for information about a process. And we mentioned that in XV6, well, every process has exactly one thread, so they didn't bother making a separate process control block, so they kind of combined these two rules. In an OS that supported multiple threads per process, we have like an array of thread control blocks in our process control block. In XV6, they've just dumped the contents of the thread control block in the process control block. And our process control block in XV6 was this struct proc, which we saw when we were looking at our system call implementation, was retrieved through this myproc function. And we kind of created that kind of like a global variable. And when we finished up last time, we mentioned, oh, the way myproc actually works is, well, there is a global variable, but the problem is that we want a different currently active process on every single core. So the solution XV6 had for that is they have an array of the values of the currently active process and some other fields for every core. And they do an array lookup based on an ID number of the core, which they retrieve with a special instruction that reads a ID number value from the processor. So that's where we finished up last time. So questions on things we covered last time, or based on my morning, or its earlier lecture on the quiz? Yes.
For the quiz, the exceptions that weren't system calls, it was question 3A.
Okay.
I was wondering, when you output to a stream, isn't that considered input and output? And so
the question is, why did, for question 3, why did outputting to the screen not require a non-system call exception? So when we talk about exceptions, those are things that run the OS. So outputting to the screen usually doesn't require that the OS run when it wouldn't already have been running, or run something it wouldn't have already been running, because the system call would trigger it to run the output to screen routine. So where we might have an exception in outputting to a screen is if the way the OS had to implement outputting to a screen is like you make a system call and the OS records that you want to output to a screen, but it needs to wait for the screen to be ready. That would be an exception, because it would be writing based on the screen running the OS when it's ready. But that's not sort of the scenario we were trying to envision here, and I don't think what you were thinking of. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. Yes?
Isn't processing aspect of data basically required?
So the question is, for B, doesn't process A asking for data require O? So this is the same situation as the screen. So if the way we implement this is we have to wait for the network to run, network device to run the OS, then yes, there would be an exception, but that's probably not the scenario we have in mind. What we have in mind is the we make a system call and the OS talks to the network device without waiting. Does that answer your question? So there's a system call, yes. And there would be an additional exception if the way the system call was implemented was something like we move away from process A or do something else and wait for the network to tell us to write, but that's not probably not what you were envisioning. Does that answer your question? Yeah. So what question is, what is a system call? So system call is when a program makes a request of the operating system that requires a request being made from user to kernel. Does that answer your question?
So how exactly is that different from a context switch?
So how is that different from a context switch? So a context switch is switching from one program to another. That can happen when a program doesn't request it. So if you write an infinite loop, the OS isn't going to run your infinite loop forever, even though you're not doing anything to request it not to keep running your infinite loop. So the context switch is just something an OS might decide to do on any kind of exception, if that makes sense to it. Does that answer your question?
So it's only for a system call when it goes through kernel mode?
So a system call is a request to do something in kernel mode. So the key attribute that distinguishes it from other types of exceptions is that it's something the program is triggering deliberately. And any sort of exception, since the OS gets to run, it can do whatever it likes. You know, it can shut down the machine, can display something, and it can like switch to another program. So like something it can do on a system call or anything else. And typically, you know, there's going to be situations where it makes sense to switch to another program versus not. Question, did I say updating the screen requires kernel mode? Yeah, so generally, we're going to treat it as if talking to input and output devices requires kernel mode. And the sort of justification for why that would typically be the case is that if we think of a typical screen on a system you've used, it's shared between multiple programs, and we want to make sure that's done in a way which doesn't cause the programs to interfere with each other, so the kernel's going to have to arbitrate that. So it is true that with some more advanced techniques we probably will not learn in this class, we could have some programs communicate more directly with devices, but that's not going to be our starting point. That answer your question? Yeah, back there. Question, why would B and D be wrong? B and E be wrong. So for B, I mentioned asking for data to be sent over the network, that's making a system call. And as long as we don't need to have the network device trigger something for that, as long as we're just sending stuff to the network device and not having the OS run in response to the network doing something, like saying, now send the data, then that happens immediately. So then you have E. Question two, why would B and E be wrong? Okay, so for B, presumably, for question two, is asking about a process context switch. So that means that are we running a different process? And for B, that we're handling the system call that writes to the network. And as part of that, it doesn't seem like we've switched to any other program. And seems like it would be hard to because we say that, you know, we only have like two processes only involved, so there's not another one to switch to. And A still has stuff to do. Does that answer your question? And other questions there?
So is the difference between system calls and other exceptions is basically like other exceptions, you don't call for other exceptions, you don't know what's going to happen, right? And for system calls.
So the question is the difference between system calls and other exceptions, that other exceptions, you don't know when they're going to happen. I wouldn't put it that way because like a seg fault, we kind of know when that happens, that those sorts of exceptions. But it's that a system call is deliberate, is the difference. And there.
Do we get access to these comments afterwards, or no?
access to these comments? What comments?
Like the comments on the actual questions.
You mean the text in green? It should be there if you look at it right now. Yes. Can I explain the wording of question four? Okay. So on question four was asking about the switch function. And we have to tell you, in order for this to make sense, we have to tell you there's going to be a first called switch that happens. And, well, it's going to set the first argument and read the second argument. And we have to tell you how that second argument is set up, or else you couldn't answer this question in a useful way. So to do that, we said B. We're telling you how B is set, the pointer B, and we're saying points to a call stack that is set the way that calling switch just before call the thread B would set it. And I've set as if because I didn't want to, because I was imagining a situation where we would have set up a call stack that way, similarly to how we said we would start a new thread. We pretend there was a call to switch and manually set up the stack that way. Even if there was a real call to switch, when you call switch, it doesn't return until something else calls switch. Because that's how switch works. So even if there's a real call to switch, that doesn't mean thread B gets to run yet, because something has to switch back to it. So that's how B is set up. And with B set up that way, thread A is called. And with that set up, now we can talk about when thread A calls switch, what happens, because now the pointer it reads, B, is valid and sensible. If that didn't happen, you'd probably have to write unknown, because what does it mean to switch to an uninitialized B? Does that answer your question? Follow-ups?
So I guess, how do we know that we start printing 1 first?
How do we know to start printing 1? So that is the first. So the setup here is that I've told you B is initialized in a particular way, and then we call thread A. And the first thing thread A does is print 1. And thread A is just a function here. Maybe I should have named these functions like function A and function B, because people got confused by that. I thought thread in the name was helpful, but maybe it wasn't. Does that answer your question?
Also, like the first thing is like the setup, but then we call thread A first?
Yeah, the supposed B is telling you how B is set up. And even if that was set up with a real call to switch, when we call switch, it doesn't return until there's another call to switch. Yes?
So if there was never a call to switch for that certain thread, the context where that thread does not exist, right?
So if there was, so you're asking, if we hadn't told you how B was set, if there was no call to switch or something like that setting B, then there would be nothing to switch to. So in that case, yeah, so when we call switch, what would happen is we use whatever the value of B is and try to set our stack to that. And if B is null, that's probably going to do something weird.
So we had to set up thread B.
So question is, if we didn't set up thread B, this question wouldn't make sense. Yeah, so if we didn't set up thread B, then you probably need to say unknown what happens when we set the stack pointer to point to presumably null. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Follow up. Okay, or I probably should look. I guess this was, okay. So let's go back to where we were. Okay, so last time we mentioned we have our process control block, something like XV6, and we have some information in here. We have our, not only our context and kernel stack, we have sort of state information. We have an ID, which we're going to see later when we manipulate processes. We need to identify which one are we talking about. We have access information about our memory and our open files. So that was our process information. And for the rest of today, also next time, we're going to talk a bunch about things at a higher level. So far we've been looking sort of at like what happens in the kernel. We're going to focus on interfaces provided to manipulate processes. And we're going to focus on the Unix ones. And we're going to focus sort of how you write user space applications, code that runs in user mode. Like, what does the interface that you're going to use look like? And we're using Unix. XP6 is based on Unix in like 2050 and so on. We have used Linux a bunch. And also, we have source code for Unix, unlike, say, Windows. So it's easier to use an example. And Unix has a long history. And one weird thing about Unix is that, well, Unix is very old, and there's lots of different versions of it. So there was an original version of Unix made in by AT&T in the late 60s, early 70s. And from that original version, there have been lots of different variants of Unix that were derived. And this is sort of a historical diagram showing lots of different variations. Lines represent sharing source code. And yes, there are things which happened, like here, where there is a version of Unix which took source code from multiple other versions of Unix. That is a thing which commonly happened. And in the 80s and 90s, there were a whole bunch of competing different variants of Unix, some of which sort of derived their source code from the original version produced by AT&T, and some of which, like Linux here, were new implementations that tried to have the same interface and the same overall design, but didn't actually share any source code with the original version of Unix from AT&T. And in the 80s and through much of the 90s, multiple versions of these were commercially viable. So it's like these days, you might say, oh, there's a whole bunch of these OSs, but like the only ones we care about might be Linux here and Mac OS X. But that was very much not true in the 80s and 90s. There were a whole bunch of these which were commercially successful, especially for like servers. Unlike today, where you run Linux on your server and then a much smaller set of other things. And the manufacturers of all these different variants of Unix got together and made a standard called POSIX, which stands for the Portable Operating System Interface. So it was a standard for Unix, and it still exists, it's still been updated. You can find the current version, which was updated in 2017, online. And it's followed, or mostly followed, by pretty much every current Unix-like OS. Tries to implement this standard, which, as the name suggests, is an interface standard. So it doesn't say, how does the kernel work? That's not part of it. Because the reason they wanted this standard is they wanted software portability. They wanted it to be the case that someone could sell you software for your server and not have it matter whether you were using HPUX or Solaris or Linux or FreeBSD. It would just work. So POSIX only specifies the library interface and the shell interface. So library, like the standard library, and the shell, meaning your command prompt. It specifies how those work. It doesn't specify how they work internally. It just specifies what the library calls are and what they do, but doesn't say, for example, that anything needs to be a system call. So for example, we've seen the write system call in XP6, and it has this corresponding library function, which is the write function. POSIX specifies that write function. It doesn't say that write function needs to actually be a system call. It doesn't care how it's implemented, but people following the original Unix design, it's going to be a system call. But POSIX doesn't care because they care about compatibility with that interface. Because their model is that you write your program once, and you look at the POSIX interface, make sure that's all you're using, and then you can recompile it for each of the Unix variants. I said recompile. So this is not a binary interface. The being able to take an executable on one Unix system and run it on another is not a goal. So their model is that you would have to recompile for each different version, but at least you could do that and it would just work. At least mostly just work. And this was like largely used like in server markets, so this was really important to people who wanted to like sell server software, that you had this common interface so you didn't have to do nearly as much work to sell one piece of software that would work on all these popular server operating systems. So that's POSIX, and we'll be learning about the POSIX interface and what it specifies, and we'll talk about the typical implementation, but remember, POSIX doesn't actually specify the implementation, it just specifies what the effects of things are, because they don't care how you actually implement it, as long as you could recompile the software and have it still work. Okay. And we're going to, in particular, look at the POSIX interface for managing processes. So we've talked sort of about what process control blocks and so on. We're going to look at what you would do as a programmer to create and stop and wait for processes. We're going to talk just about a subset of the POSIX library calls, which typically are implemented with system calls, but as I said, POSIX doesn't actually specify whether that's the case, that deal with processes. I'll start with probably the simplest one, which is to get information about the current process. So there's get PID. So PID is process ID. And the way this might look is we call the get PID function, and it returns a PIDT. You might say, why does it return a PIDT? What is that? So that's some sort of integer. Since POSIX is trying to be portable, they didn't want to say what type of integer is it, so they made a typedef. So you include a header file, and you get this PIDT, which is an alias for int or long, who knows, one of those, some sort of integer. And get PID returns your current process's PID. So in XV6, if we remember our process control block, we had this PID field. And in XV6, the get PID implementation is a system call that returns that number from the current process. Something else you might notice is that when I'm calling printf, I cast the PID to a type. This is because I don't know how big an integer it is, and I want to make sure printf works correctly. So I cast it to something that matches the format string I'm using with printf. Questions about get PID. So this process ID, this number, is a unique identifier for a running process. You can might have also seen them if you run commands like ps, which is list the current processes I'm running. You've seen some of these similar things, like if you look at the Windows Task Manager, you've seen Windows equivalent of these. There's an identifier for processes, and as I said, POSIX only specifies the interface, so it doesn't say how these are assigned. Most commonly, it's like a counter or a random number. The only important thing is that two different processes have two different process IDs. Okay, so questions? Okay, so that's kind of process IDs, pretty simple. Next, we're going to talk about creating processes. And before I get onto that, something you might notice on this slide is I have process creation is separate from running programs. So this is a weird choice POSIX makes. So I'm going to talk about creating new processes, but not running a different program. So we're going to create a new process that's running the same program. And we're going to have a separate operation for running a different program. And we'll talk about how that works. This is a choice that POSIX makes that things like Windows did not make. And it makes some things very peculiar. And the main operation to create a new process is going to be called fork. So fork copies the current process. Since we copy the current process, including its current thread, we're going to have two threads after the copying. In one of those threads, we're going to return a new process ID. And that's the original thread, which we call the original process, I should say, which we call the parent. And another one, we're going to return 0. That's the child. The way I remember this is that, well, in the parent, I can figure out what my process ID is already, but I have no way of figuring out the child's process ID without some help, so fork returns it. In the child process, the new one, which is going to have a new process ID, I can figure out my new process ID by calling getPID, which we've seen, and I could figure out the parent process ID by calling getPID before fork happens and storing that somewhere. So fork is just returning the information we need as a process ID and returning 0 in the child so we can figure out that we're in the child process. Because we're copying everything, without these different return values, we'd have no way of writing code which acts differently in the two different processes. Well, no easy way of writing code that's different in the new process versus the old one. This return value is how we're going to do that. Yes? Question is, the PID the only metadata in this process? It depends what you call metadata. So as mentioned here, we're going to keep the file descriptors are going to be duplicated. And there might be some other specific information. But generally, we're going to duplicate most of that. Does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, at the end of the process, the child gets own PID. So we assign a new process ID to the child because every process needs to have a unique ID. Other questions? Yeah.
So this would just basically run two of the same programs?
So this will run two of the same programs, starting with returning for fork. So the implementation is we have a process control block. It has save registers, it has a pointer to our kernel stack, it has our pointers to all the memory we have for our program, it has information about what files are open, all that stuff we've seen. And we're going to make a copy of it, and it's not going to be a shallow copy, it's going to be a deep copy, which means we're going to copy the current, make a new kernel stack, copy all the memory, so on. And that's what fork does, and we're going to distinguish the two copies by returning different values. So in x86, we do that by setting the EAX register to different values depending on whether it's the copy or the original. Yes? Sorry, is the code for... Oh, so is the code for 442? I just chose an example number. I'm just talking about, more generically, in XV6, it's a different number. Yeah?
Does it choose the PID randomly?
Question, does it choose the PID randomly? So POSIX, as I said, doesn't specify the interface. So it doesn't specify the implementation. It just says the PIDs need to be unique. In practice, you will find systems that both choose the PID as an incrementing number or choose it randomly. Yeah.
I might have missed it from a prior slide, but why does the parent's PID change?
Question, why does the parent's PID change? It does not. So I probably should add to this slide, there's a PID field, which starts out as some value. So let's say the parent's PID is 100, and the child's PID is 152. In that case, this would be 152. So the value of the EAX register is not the PID of the current process. That is a separate thing that's stored in the process control block. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah.
So for a child's PID, it turns to 0 initially and then gets its own later.
So question, for the child's PID, it turns to 0 initially, so it gets its own unique one later. No, so there's some confusion. What fork returns is either the new PID for the parent to use, or for the child, it's 0, which is just a flag to indicate this is the child right now. So it's just kind of, we're kind of encoding two different things in that field. maybe a better design would have like returned a struct or something, but that's not what POSIX, what Unix chose in the 70s. And POSIX has kept imitating till today. Yes?
So the EAX register is not storing the PID. What exactly is it storing?
It's a question, what is the EAX register storing if it's not the PID? The EAX register is the return value of fork in this example. Because that's what, you know, that's where we expect it in x86. Yes? How does fork return to two different programs? So we've copied the entire program. So now we have two copies of the same registers. And they're gonna, and when we run using one of them, we'll run one thread. When we run using another, we'll run another thread, and they'll both be starting in the same place. Does that answer your question? Yeah, and I guess if we didn't change the, you know, the return value, they do the same thing as long as they didn't make system calls. But we do change the return value, so they'll do different things. Other questions? OK. So let's look at an example of fork. So here's a little program that uses fork and uses getPID. So the first thing we do is, before we fork, we get our current process ID, which is going to be the process ID of the parent process as far as this fork operation is concerned. And then we call fork, and we get have this variable called child PID, which is either the child PID if we're in the parent, or zero if we're in the child. So if we're in the parent, we check, figure that out, because the child PID is not is greater than zero. And in that case, I print out parent PID is the parent of child PID. In the child, I print out the child PID is the child, and then I exit. That fork can also fail. So most common reason why is if we're out of memory. And I have some code to handle that here. So when fork fails, it returns a negative number instead of a process ID. And I use this peer function, which prints out the string colon and an error message. It turns out all the POSIX calls send a special variable called erno to indicate what type of error happened. And PRR prints an arguably human-readable message about that. I say arguably human-readable because resource temporarily unavailable. Maybe you don't consider that really human-readable, but it's better than a number. And this sort of thing, this call can be used for lots of the library calls in POSIX, which fail like this. Okay, so that's our fork. And when it doesn't fail, a typical output might look like this. So here, it happens that our initial process ID is 100. And then we call fork. And it happens to be the case that after we call fork, the parent keeps running, and then the child runs. So the parent keeps running, it prints out 100, parent of 432. Then the child runs and prints out 432, child. And the child process ID happened to be 432. Note that, of course, the process IDs could be different in practice. And also, the order in which the parent and child run could be different, just because they're two separate processes. And when that timer goes off, we might switch between them at different times. Questions? Yeah. So the question is, 432 child could print first, and 100 parent of 432 could print next? Yes, that is a possibility. Yes?
Does the second fork process start at the same line, or does it start at the beginning?
So the question is, where does the new process start? It starts returning from fork the same place that your parent process is. Because remember, they have the same stack and registers. So the stack of the when we call fork is about to return from fork, that's where the child starts, with that same stack about to return from fork. Other questions? Yeah. Okay. So speaking of different possibilities, so here's an example with fork. And I'm saying, let's suppose our PID of our parent process is 99 and the PID of the child process is 100. So give two possible outputs. And assume no crashes, so like fork doesn't fail. You can check with your neighbors. There are more than two possible outputs. So only ask you to find two of them. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, who can give me one possible output? Anyone? Yeah.
In child, done 100.
So in child, then done?
Then done.
Okay.
Then child 100.
Child 100,
then done.
Then done. Okay. So this is assuming that we call fork, and then we create our new child process, and the OS decides to switch to it right away. And we run it until it completes main, and then we need to switch to something else, and eventually we switch back to the parent process. It prints out child 100, 100 was the return value of fork that was set up as part of that copying the process, and then it prints done and exits. Okay. So I have another possible output. Yeah. Okay. Okay. So in child 100, then
done.
So you're proposing that we, you know, we start by switching to the child, and then after we print out the first thing, we switch back to the parent, and back, and then we switch back to the child. Yeah. So that's another possibility. Any others? Okay, so you're saying we could also have the parent run to completion first and then the child. Yeah. So those are three different possibilities. I have two on the slide where I've sort of drawn out the difference. It's just that while we're switching between these programs, we don't know exactly when that happens. There's lots of possibilities based on the details of that timing. And there's probably some more possibilities. So something that no one brought up that maybe could happen is, what if we switch while we're in the middle of printing out a string? If like printf were implemented like x36 does it, right, where it prints out a character by character, there's a whole bunch of different things that could happen then.
So could it possibly switch out in the string?
Question, could it possibly switch out in the middle string? So if printf is implemented the way xv6 does it, where it prints character by character, absolutely. If it's implemented the way typical OSs do it, most likely not. So it wouldn't be unheard of to happen between when child and the number is printed, but most likely not. But that depends on something that, well, POSIX doesn't specify, right? Because it just says printf prints this thing, doesn't say whether it does it all at once or not. Yeah?
Would it be another process between the parent and child when the fork?
Could there be another process between the parent and child? Before execution running? Absolutely. If there are other programs on the system, they could absolutely run in between. Presumably, they wouldn't be outputting to the same terminal. At least it would be a weird question if they were, but yeah. Other questions? Okay, so that's fork. So this gives us a way to start new processes, and we can see we can do different things in that new process. But this really doesn't match what you probably think of as starting a new process. You think of, like, open a shell and run a program in a new process. And we can only run the current program in a new process, which doesn't seem so useful. So how do we run a different program? And there's a different API for running a different program, which is not going to involve making a new process. So there's actually a bunch of POSIX functions which all start with exec. We'll talk in particular about execv, but there's a whole bunch of them that basically just differ in how they take their arguments. And what exec does is it replaces the current program with a new program. It keeps the same process and replaces what I call the process image. So it like changes all the memory for to be memory for a new program, but we use the same process control block, and therefore the same process ID. And the way execv, which is the variant of exec we're going to talk about, works is it takes the path to the executable to run and the values for argv. Remember, when we write main with arguments, we take an argc and an argv, so we just pass the values in argv, and since that's an array, we need to know how long it is, we're going to just terminate it with a null pointer. We'll show you an example of how you could set argv in a bit. So questions about this exec API? Yes? So the question, when it creates a new program, does it also alter the trap frame? So they're replacing the program. We're basically going to overwrite the process control block to have values for the new program we're running, including changing all the registers, all the memory, and so on. Yes? What, sorry? What is the trap frame pointing to? So in XV6, the trap frame is how they implement saving the registers in users from user space. Sorry, what is the? Oh, the path variable. Okay, I misheard you. What is the path variable referring to? So we have to specify where the executable we're running is. So, okay, other questions? I'll show you an example on the next slide. But so let's look at example on the next slide. So fork very commonly is used with execv because, well, usually we want to run a program and also do other things afterwards. And if we're replacing our current program with a different program, well, when that program finishes, our original program isn't running anymore because it replaces it. So typically what you'll see done is we'll make a new process, and then we'll replace that new process rather than keeping running the same program. It will run a new program, and we'll still have the original non-clone process, which can keep running afterwards. So if you think of your shell, you type a command like ls minus l, it spawns ls minus l in a new process, and when ls minus l finishes, it can go back to being to taking your commands. If it just exec ls minus l, then when ls minus l finished, ls minus l would exit, and then there would be nothing running. So this is the typical pattern you'll see. And you can see here, in this case, I make a child process. And in that child process, I'm running the program slash bin ls. So this is where the ls executable. So this is the output of the compiler. Someone compiled ls earlier. And I'm passing arguments to it. And the convention on Unix is that the argv of 0 is the name the user typed on the command line. And the remaining arguments are the arguments after that. And with execv, we have to terminate that with a null pointer so we know how many arguments there are. And your shell, you'll type ls, it will figure out where the executable is, which is why in this example I have ls versus is the name in on the command line that you'd have typed, but it would run bin ls. Yes? So wouldn't calling execv call the stack, clog the stack? So when execv works successfully, we're going to throw away the existing stack and all of the existing program's memory and load a completely new program in its place. So we don't have to worry about clogging up the stack or anything like that. When execv doesn't work, it's going to return. And if that happens, we know, well, we aren't running a different program, so something must have went wrong, which is why I have code to print out an error in exit. Other questions? Yeah.
So in this situation with ls, how does the operating system make sure to finish ls before it continues?
So question, how does the operating system make sure to finish ls before it runs the parent, keeps running the parent? It does not. So if we want to do that, the code in the dot, dot, dot is going to need to do something about that, and we'll see exactly what that is in a bit. Other questions? So if we think about process control blocks, we have our initial program running, then we run exec, and the OS is going to allocate space for the new program we want to load. It's going to load its code and data from the executable. It's going to copy over the arguments, and then it's going to throw away the old memory. And importantly, as we'll see later, it's going to change the memory and the current registers, but it's not going to change things like open files, current directory, things like that. So questions about what exec does? Yes?
The new process being run on the parent memory.
So question is, the new process is being run in the parent memory? I would say it's the same process, because it's the same struct proc, but we're running a new program in it, meaning we've changed all the fields related to what program is running to be for a different program. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, we're doing all of that on the process that existed before it. Not
yeah, the question if we're doing all that on the existing process, yeah. So whatever process calls execv, that's what we're changing. And this means that execv normally doesn't return. Because when it would return, instead a different process, the same process running a different program. Other questions? Okay. So something people usually complain about with this is that they think, wait a moment, so you're telling me that when my shell wants to run ls, we're going to copy the entire shell with fork and then discard that copy shortly afterwards. And that seems really wasteful. And there's two answers to that. So one answer is that when we talk about virtual memory, we'll learn that this copy is maybe a little better than it looks because there's some tricks we can do. And secondly, yes, it is wasteful. It is not the most efficient way of doing this. We could, instead, just have a function and a corresponding system call, presumably, just to create a new program directly. And in fact, this is what other OSs do. Windows has create process, which creates a new process running a particular program. It doesn't clone the current one. And POSIX has a rarely used and often poorly implemented thing which does that called POSIX spawn. Now, the main advantage of this fork exec idea is that we can easily set up the state of the program we're running in a particular way. So for example, let's say I want to run a program in a particular directory. With the create process API, there better be an argument to create process that lets me specify that sort of information. If I want to change that, make that different. With the fork exec idea, I fork, and before I call exec, I change the current directory. I don't need to have an extra argument to exec to make that possible. So there's some advantages to POSIX's choice, but the big disadvantage is the OS needs to copy the whole process code, which even with the tricks that we'll learn about later when we talk about virtual memory for doing this efficiently, is maybe not so efficient. But by and large, it's still what Unix-like OSs do. They often have some variants of fork that take some shortcuts to be a little more efficient than normal fork, but it's still basically the same idea. We're making a new process that's a copy of the current one, mostly. I mentioned there's this POSIX spawn. I'll show you what POSIX spawn looks like. But as I mentioned, it's often not very well implemented. But POSIX spawn was made by the POSIX people in the 2000s. As sort of a response to realizing maybe fork exec isn't so great. So it takes a pointer to a new PID, the program to run, and it has these bunch of these optional arguments for setting up the environment of the new program. So like we can change what files are open. We can have some other settings like changing the current directory and things like that. And all these sorts of things that otherwise we might do by just writing some code to like change directory or open files before we exec in the child process. And when I say it's implemented poorly, the main issue with POSIX spawn is that where it's supported, often it's implemented by calling fork, not by doing the what you would think would be the more efficient thing of making a new process, quote unquote, from scratch. But on an OS like Windows, where create process is sort of the only thing, they just create a process from scratch rather than doing this copy thing. So we're going to learn the old Unix way, and in the shell assignment, you're probably not going to be writing POSIX spawn. You're probably going to be writing code like this, the upcoming shell assignment, which we'll talk more about probably Thursday. But there's a lot of people who don't really like fork, so the Hot Topics in Operating Systems workshop has this rant with this abstract, which says, we catalog the ways in which fork is a terrible abstraction for the modern programmer to use. Describe how it compromises OS implementations and propose alternatives. So there's some people who really think fork maybe was not such a good idea, but it's what All the Unix-like OSs still use, yes, they have alternatives, but the OS makers are not really placing priority on those alternatives. It's really based on the fork design still. Even though maybe that wasn't a great choice, but it's what they chose. So, questions on fork and exec? Okay, so someone asked the question about, wait a moment, so when we do this, how does the OS know not to keep running the parent process until the child is done here? Because like in our shell, we think, oh, we run ls, we want the shell not to prompt until ls is done. How does that happen? Well, we have to do something here that waits for a program, and the operation for that we're going to talk about is wait PID. So there's a call to wait for a process to finish. There's also one called wait. We'll talk about wait PID. So that waits for a process to finish. If we don't do that, then the shell just keeps running alongside ls, which for ls, probably not useful. But if like we're running like your web browser, that's probably what you want. You want your web browser to run while your shell keeps running. So that's why it's a choice. So wait PID, this is what the prototype for wait PID looks like. So it takes a process ID to wait for, a place to put what we'll call a status, which is information about how did the process finish, and some options. We are not going to talk about those options. We're always going to use zero, but you can specify some variants of how wait PID should behave. And note from this description, a key attribute here is that wait PID waits for a child process. So you can only wait for processes that you created with fork or something similar. If you want to wait for something that is not a process you created, then you can't do it with wait PID, at least not without something that's not part of POSIX, that's not portable, that's going to be like Linux or OS X specific. Yes?
It's like what, ampersand command on Linux?
Question, is this like the ampersand command on Linux? So we'll talk about that. So this is, as I said, waits for a program to finish. So if we call wait PID, then we're going to wait for that program to finish and be done. If you used ampersand in the shell, that runs a program and doesn't wait for it to finish. So the difference in what your shell's doing when you pass an ampersand versus not is when you pass an ampersand, it doesn't call wait PID right away. And if you don't pass ampersand, it does. Does that answer your question? So this is what we use when we want to pause while waiting for a program to finish. So that program needs to be one week spawned, and we can pass the PID to wait for. You can also use this if you spawn lots of different programs to wait for the first one to finish, in which case you pass negative one for the PID. And whichever one finishes first, you'll get the status of it, and wait PID will return the process ID of that program. And the status, well, it's an integer. You might say, so what is that integer? And it tells you how the program exited. So one thing it can tell you about is the exit status. So if you know main or exit, you pass a number, you return a number for main, pass a number to exit, and the convention on Unix is that zero typically means the program worked successfully, and any other thing means it didn't. So this is known as an exit status, but that you can retrieve, but the status information also has other information. So this is waiting for the program to finish, not waiting for it to exit. So the status information is kind of like a struct encoded in a single integer, and it includes the exit status. But also, the program can exit for other reasons. So for example, let's say I run a program and it segfaults. Or I run a program and it exits because I type control C. That's not exiting with an exit status, so we still want to get that information though. And the way POSIX has decided to deal with this is that the status integer will have either the exit status or some flags that let you know about those other forms of termination. And you use these macros that start with a capital W to figure out how to interpret it. So this W if exited tells you Does this status number represent a normal xset as by returning for main or calling xset? And if so, then you can call wxset status to get the value that was passed to xset or returned from main. But let's say it wasn't. Then we're going to have some other reason it xsetted, and most of these are represented as signals. Talk a bit about signals on the next slide. So if it's signal, w if signal will be set, and you can get a signal ID from this w term sig macro. And signals are going to represent most forms of abnormal termination. So you're going to say, where's the name signal come from? So signals are primarily a way of communicating between processes. This is all I'm going to talk about signals, because we don't really care about them except that they come up for abnormal termination, because control C triggers a signal that usually causes the process to terminate. Segfaults trigger a signal that usually causes the process to terminate. So all these forms of abnormal termination are going to be marked as killed by a signal. And there's going to be a different signal number for control C versus a segfault versus, say, the kill command to terminate a process from another process, and so on. So that's how we represent all the forms of abnormal termination, and that's how your shell can tell that the program segfaulted versus just exiting. So questions about decoding our exit status or statuses? So those are our statuses, and the typical use of wait PID, but this is not the way you have to use it, is that we'll call fork, we'll do something which typically execs but might not, and then exits in the child, and in the parent we'll wait PID to wait for the child to finish before we move on. This is the most common use, but it's not what you have to do. If you want to run something in the background, you just don't wait PID right away. That's the difference. And something that, pointing out what wait PID, so what we typically imagine is that, like, you fork, you have a child process. In that child process, you call exec. The program that you start running after exec eventually exits, and that makes wait PID finish. But, of course, you don't actually always have things work out this way. We mentioned when we talked about how fork worked that it doesn't have to be the case that the parent and child run in any particular order. The OS can switch between them. So maybe what happens is you call fork and we spend a lot of time running the child process before we get to the wait PID in the parent process. You might say, isn't that a problem? No, it's not. So wait PID, if you ask to wait for something that's already finished, it's going to tell you about it finishing. That's fine. You can call it after something's finished, and the OS needs to remember it finished and give you how it finished. So wouldn't some of the fork code run before your child code? So most likely, but I mean, not necessarily. POSIX doesn't say whether POSIX allows an OS to implement fork by, like, running the child first. That is permitted. I'm not sure how common that is. And even if it doesn't, like, depends how the timing works out, right? But that's fine, because the way wait PID is defined is that you can wait for things that have already finished, in which case wait PID just returns, yes, it finished, here's its status. Yeah? So, question, the difference between these two slides is whether the child process runs after, how quickly the child process runs after fork, is that what you're getting at? Where does fork return to? So fork returns in both. So I'm just saying fork happens, and we run the parent, and we run the child as a result. Does that answer your question? And it doesn't matter when we call wait PID, it's still going to work, so it's going to remember things that have already finished, and you can still wait for them. And that's important, or else, you know, we couldn't make this timing work out. Yes?
So what are the practical use cases for using wait PID? I'd imagine, like, if you want functions to run in a particular order, or
So question, why would we use wait PID? So the classic example is the shell. If you want to run the ls command, and you don't want to print your prompt in the middle of ls printing out, you use wait PID to make sure you wait to print that prompt until ls is done. And you don't really have an alternative to that. You might say, well, can't we just exec ls and then go back to our shell? But no, because the problem is ls doesn't know what to go back to. So the way you handle that is you make a new process to run ls, and then ls just exits, and then that goes back because you're waiting for that process. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
What is the benefit of this pattern?
What is the benefit of this pattern? So the question is, what's the benefit of this pattern? So I should say, these are both examples of the same pattern as far as the code goes, but there's two different ways that same code could execute. And it's very important that both of them work. Because if both of them didn't work, then our shell sometimes mysteriously wouldn't be able to wait for a program to finish. It would just hang or something like that. Does that answer your question? Couldn't the still end up in the middle of us? Wait PID will never return before the child process finishes. So in our other ordering, wait PID was called before the child process finished. That's fine. Wait PID is not going to return until that exit actually happens. Does that answer your question? Other questions? So that's our typical pattern, and this is by far the most common way you'll see for running programs, and you'll see this everywhere on Unix, is this pattern of fork, exec in the child process, wait PID in the parent. For the very common operation of run a program, wait for it to finish, get its result, see if it succeeded or not, and then go back to the original program we were running before that. And I guess I should note that, so that's the most common thing. Technically, we don't have to do things like that because, you know, wait PID, you can wait for a particular program. So you could, say, spawn a whole bunch of processes by calling fork multiple times and then wait for them all at once. Or you could wait for them, whichever one finishes first. I mentioned you pass -1 to wait PID, it returns whatever finishes next. That's a child process. That's fine. So next time, we'll pick up with a little exercise on fork and exec, and then talk about files. So we've mentioned about sort of managing processes, but an important part of managing processes is what files, what they can read and write, and how that interacts with fork and exec. We'll talk about that next time, and also the shell assignment. So that's where I'll finish up to be synced with the other lecture where the discussion of the quiz was even longer.